Welcome to Life, Death, and the Law, presented by the law firm of Deason, Garner, and Hanson, hosted by attorneys Sean Garner and Adam Hanson.
So we're back on this transgender athletes competing and displacing biological females from the top spots in athletic competitions. And I know I, for one, have heard so much about this that I normally just scroll right past these stories. But recently there was a regional athletic competition that happened in California where a transgender female won by large margins in track and field for the triple jump and the long jump. Her name's A.B. Hernandez. And so when she got off the top spot on the podium, the true female winner of the track meet stood on that top spot for a moment and got some pictures from whoever, probably her family members, and the crowd gave her a standing ovation.
Oh, is that right? I didn't hear that.
Yeah, and apparently there's this new, it barely got implemented policy that if a transgender athlete wins a competition that would otherwise displace a biological female athlete, then both will be able to compete at the next level. The question remains, at the next level, being the state competition, if the transgender female goes on to win that competition, who gets the gold? Do they award a gold to the transgender female and the biological female that won second place, but first place among the females? Or how does that work? I guess that's the question. I think that the transgender question is such an obvious one. People have taken sides, they've dug in, and you're not going to convince somebody otherwise by rationally and logically reasoning this issue. But it's come closer to home with you more recently, Adam, and with your brother Trent being in this the school system in Southern California. I don't know how he's remained sane over all these years, but so what's going on with him? He was in the district that this occurred. So what's been the backlash that he's been experiencing?
Yeah, he's not just in it. He runs it. He's the superintendent of the district where this is taking place. So I got a text from him last week and he said, "Hey, do you know so-and-so? Does he have a way to get a hold of President Trump or his staff?" And I was like, "I think he does. Yeah. Why? What's going on?" And he's like, "Oh, well, I'm having some issues here in my district." And so that's when I came to my knowledge of this issue that's going on with A.B. Hernandez.
Reached out to you about being able to get a hold of President Trump?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so he's like, "I'm going to be meeting with Newsom's team tomorrow." This was last week. And his staff. And so we'll try and he's like, "I just want to work this out." And I said, "Well, my question was, I don't understand. I thought President Trump signed that executive order that allowed or that says that no male athletes,
biological male that's transitioned to female, yes,
participate in female sports. I thought that was, you know, a sweeping executive order across the United States. And I thought that trumps state law in California."
And but what teeth does it have, really?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, apparently none in California. And so my brother said, "Well, yeah, I mean, it depends on your attorney general. And our attorney general here in California, he doesn't recognize that as law. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we've got the state law saying it's allowed. And then we've got the feds saying, no, it's not allowed." And Trump tweeting the tweet that you just kind of alluded to, which was kind of this firestorm that brought everything up, but he said, "I'm going to withhold federal funding." And it wasn't really clear from the tweet, like, what federal funding is he talking about? And in talking to my brother, he said, "Well, I'm stuck in the middle. You know, I, on one side, have to deal with California coming down on me and say, no, you have to let this person participate, or we're going to withhold $237 million of your funding to your district." And then you have the feds saying, "Hey, we're going to withhold federal funding to the tune of $17 million." Mm-hmm. And so if it's a numbers game, it's pretty easy. I'm going to side with California in that sense. But it's not just a numbers game. It really goes to the core of
Because he got some pretty scathing emails and texts that says, oh, yeah, hey,
all the time,
why are you letting our female athletes be trampled over by these transgender athletes? And I understand there is a policy, and California's policy is to allow that to happen, but you are the superintendent.
Decision maker.
Yeah, you get
to say no.
You get to decide
that. You don't get to play.
And maybe you lose your job. Maybe you lose your funding, but somebody's got to stand up to this at some point. So he's getting these threats from parents on one side.
Anonymous, you know.
Are they anonymous?
Yeah. I mean, you read really? That one. Yeah, it's like, yeah, okay. Yeah, you're so tough.
Yeah.
When you do this, it's like you have no position to lose and you have nothing in this fight.
Yeah, exactly. Your family's not going to be out.
Exactly. Where my brother's been there for 23 years, you know.
His whole pension.
And we'll lose everything.
Yeah, they'd probably strip him of his pension and all of his retirement benefits. I mean,
the world would cave in on him.
So, okay.
So what would you do?
Is there a silver lining? What would I do personally? Oh, gosh. I have no idea. I am in no position to say what I would do because it's not my family's livelihood on the line. And I can easily sit back here, you know, and Monday morning quarterback type stuff. And that's not going to do anybody favors. But what I see as a silver lining is that there's far too much federal government involvement in state activities. And there's far too much state involvement in local activities. And so I think that federal government needs to pull back. They need to make good on their threats. And then let's have this demonstrate that we don't actually need the federal government. Like Gavin Newsom, what he should do is say, if he really thinks that this is a good policy for his state, for his constituents and the residents there, then continue running your state the way you think you ought to, Gavin. Get the federal government out of your state. See how many people stay around and enjoy what results in how you manage things. We've seen how it's been managed so far and that people are fleeing, you know, literally in the millions. Mm-hmm. And the people that stick around, great. Enjoy that type of policy and keep my money that I'm paying into the tax coffers out of your policy-making decisions. Then let's see what other states do. When we get the federal government out of it, we get the states being more independent, which they were intended to be initially in the Constitution, and you get this 50-state experimental situation where each person gets to see how state policies affect the population, and then they get to choose by voting with their feet which government works the best.
Yeah, so I mean, you're describing the classic idea of federalism, right?
Sure, yeah. And
federalism in that federal government should leave the states to do what they do, with the exception of a few things constitutionally. I mean, the Supreme Court has said what
Border Patrol.
Yeah. The states don't have
jurisdiction. Interstate commerce.
I think those are probably the two big ones.
Yeah.
Maybe education.
Well, and I don't know.
Which is weird because
education certainly I don't think fits in a constitutional realm unless you do some really mental gymnastics and jumping around and saying, well, if we put these two words together that aren't in the same articles, then yeah, we can make that work. Mm-hmm. In reality, no. The federal government is there to make sure that the states cooperate, to be the final arbiter about what decisions are regarding disputes between the states, to make sure that one state doesn't discriminate against another with tariffs against that other state, or discriminate against transportation with residents from another state. And that's about it. The states then get to make up their laws. And most people we hear on the news, federal issues, federal laws, federal agents doing things. But when you go to the courthouse, 99% of it is state.
Yeah.
It's a state law that is being prosecuted, whether it's a burglary, you know, somebody breaking into a house, or whether it's
contract.
Say what?
Contract.
You're right, a contract being broken between, you know, a home builder and a contractor, or any other type of thing like that. That's all state law, and that is what is being litigated. But those aren't sensational. They don't make the national news. So the 1% that becomes a federal issue, that's what makes the national news, and that's what we pay attention to. And it's unfortunate. Now, so the states do have a lot of autonomy in making their laws and enforcing their laws. But what happens is when the federal government wants something, we've accepted so much of money from the federal government, and we have allowed the federal government, we've been complacent in these taxes, which are really the bulk of what we pay out when it comes to government funding. It's the federal government that we're paying taxes to, not our state and local taxes, that if they threaten to withdraw that funding on any policy issue, then, you know, we just cave in and dance the dance. And that is where that's got to stop. If states stopped doing that, stopped accepting that federal funding, then we wouldn't have to comply with the government policies, even though they're against what we stand for individually as both constituents and policymakers in the state.
Yeah, I hear you to say, so the real power that the Trump administration has over California is the purse strings. And that's been historically what Congress would use or a president would use, saying you've been taking all this gravy and we're going to cut the gravy train.
Yeah.
If you don't do what we want you to do, whether you like that or not, even if it goes against your state laws. And so I hear you say you've come to a conclusion. If you're in my brother's spot, you're the superintendent of this district, you would probably side with California in the sense of I'm going to do the federalism.
On a personal level, I don't know that I have the spine and I'm not in his position. So I'm not going to say I would do this because I'm not there. And I think that's incredibly like slimy of me to say that I would stand up against the Goliath and be the David in this story. But theoretically, I think that that's the answer.
What's the answer?
To stand up and say, fine, take the money. Take the money away from us. Let us function without your money, but let us do what we think is right.
Stand up to the Trump administration or to the California Attorney General.
Well, in Trent's situation, right, he's governed by the state,
yeah,
right? And so is he autonomous in his district, or is he really just a player in a larger role? The state is the government there, right? And he has to abide by the state policies.
Exactly right. Not only that, but he's got to keep the parents happy.
The school board.
That's his employer. And so if it's made up of individuals that side with state policy, mm-hmm, of allowing transgenders, then it's suicide. Employment suicide.
So really, who is his boss? Is Gavin Newsom his boss, or is it the parents of the school district? Okay.
Right.
Yeah, no, he is stuck in an impossible position.
Yeah.
And but can you imagine if we had states that actually were able to keep the money that their residents produced based on the services and products that they were providing and got to run their governments exactly based on their own policies that their state lawmakers were making, and these state Senate and legislative elections became way more popular and involved than the national ones because they would affect us directly. And so we were paying close attention to those state races because they're going to affect us at home. And then we look at Texas and we look at New Mexico and we look at Colorado and we look at California and we see the diversity and how those states thrive or struggle under those types of policies because they're left on their own to implement and succeed or drown. That would be amazing. Instead of having the federal government continuing to level the playing field, as they like to call it, but what in reality that means is taking from the very successful states and giving to the unsuccessful states, so we don't see the stark contrast as obvious as it would be when those policies are implemented.
Is there a way that a state can bring in revenue besides taxes? I was jokingly talking to a friend of ours who's an attorney as well, Brandon, and in jest, I was like, hey, I think we should get rid of all state taxes here in Arizona, where mm-hmm. we are. Because
property and sales tax and taxes. Income tax.
Yeah, going to the tariff model that we're seeing from the federal side, because I think that's what Trump is trying to posit for the nation. Hey, mm-hmm. we don't need the tax. In fact, taxes were unconstitutional federally, like beginning of our history.
Yeah, until like the 16th Amendment.
Mm-hmm. I think that was 1923-ish, around there, I think, something like that. It came and went.
Oh yeah, I'll fact check you as you go.
Yeah, in order to fund different wars and things like that, and then until it became a permanent thing through the 16th Amendment. Which I'm like, why do we do that? The states had to ratify that. And that means the states were on board with taxing its citizenry federally. I don't understand. I want to look into the history of that.
Coming up, more thought-provoking conversations on life, death, and the law right after this. You're listening to Life, Death, and the Law, presented by Deason, Garner, and Hanson, the law firm that has been voted Yuma's best 6 years in a row.
And then can we undo that? But anyway, getting back to the point, Trump has talked about eliminating federal income tax altogether and using a tariff system that we used to use in the very beginning to bring in income from other countries around the world.
Yeah.
And
but how do we do that on a state level?
I don't know. That's the question. Saying
that's what the federal government does do and is explicitly in the Constitution, that you can't impose tariffs on other states.
Interstate commerce.
Right. Right? It's got to be free.
Yeah.
Trade.
So in my conversation, I talked about, I think we should just get rid of all taxes in Arizona on the state level. And then we charge tariffs, if you will, or, you know, income tax on those, or not income tax, but a product tax for people coming into our state. And it really does make a lot of sense once you start to think about it. It's like, yeah, I mean, our citizens are protected and it incentivizes us to sell and manufacture here in the state of Arizona and then get other states it doesn't matter, foreign or domestic, come in and buy our products from Arizona and then we're charging them a higher premium.
Yeah.
And then we use that money to pay for our roads, our schools, and things like that.
Yeah, but when the Founding Fathers were putting together the Constitution, that idea came up, and it was actually being implemented at the time with the states.
Southern states.
Yes.
Tobacco.
And what was happening is we had the Articles of Confederation.
Confederation. Uh-huh.
And it wasn't working because it was these 13 states that were working independently, and they weren't strong enough independently to, you know, the freedom of their individuals from any invading country. They had to unite together in order
for... bargaining power for foreign countries? Is that what you're saying? Like,
well, no. So individually, a foreign country could come in and either give them a sweeter deal, right, than the other states, and they say, yeah, okay, we accept that, and then they would basically lure that state away, and the states would be separated, and they would become too weak to... individually stand, and then we wouldn't have a country at all. We'd have just a conglomerate of states that eventually worked apart into different countries. And so they said, no, we can't do that. We've got to unify. We have to have a stronger central government, because right now we are trying to, like the South was trying to be lured away by Europe into doing different deals than they were going to be doing with the North. And so they said, we need to unify together, otherwise this country is just going to fail. So that is where they said, okay, states can't treat other states with a tariff or with additional restrictions, whether it's travel or other things like that. And they have to also honor their laws, their, you know, full faith and credit clause in the Constitution, that they have to honor other states' laws. And so if a state makes a law, that law doesn't stop when the citizen of that state crosses the border. And I think that's a good thing. I think that we do need to have a nation.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting concept of the tariffs, but there's got to be a better way to do it, to fund, you know, what we need to have done by the federal government. One way to do it is, first of all, really think about what do we need to have done by the federal or even the state government that can't be done privately. I think there's very few services that can't be done privately better, more efficiently, and cost much less. And so the tax issue, maybe it doesn't go away, but it becomes so small that it's not one of these major talking points that we have every day. For example, let's just go with a pretty radical example right off the bat. Police. Do we need a state police force? Could we have individual contractors that say, listen, we'll contract with your city and we will provide protection. Obviously, Not all homeowners want to stay home all day with a rifle on the roof, making sure that somebody doesn't break in their house and steal all their stuff and, you know, leave the house ransacked. So we offer protection for that, and the state will make a law that will make that illegal. And if somebody does that, then you will allocate or assign your authority, delegate your authority to us to stop that person by force if necessary, and put them into these units that we have prepared to keep people that break the law until they were ready to stand trial at a court, at a state court. And so the city says, yeah, we'll do that. And then all these different cities have private contractors that have this ability to do that. Those private contractors are subject to civil lawsuits, like if they actually abuse civil rights of individuals wrongfully. But if they're demonstrated to show, no, we were actually just enforcing the law, and that law was properly, that right was properly delegated to us by the people. After all, it is a government of the people, for the people, by the people. So we are the government, and we can delegate that authority. So this private security force comes in and does that, and one company does a very good job at a reasonable fee and keeps the crime rate significantly lower. Other cities say, yeah, we like that. Let's duplicate that. And then other companies say, well, they're doing a good job. Let's duplicate their method. Now we've got this competition of companies,
capitalism,
that,
sure,
that are all out there to provide the security at the most efficient rate and do it also that would mind the civil rights of the individuals that are allegedly breaking the laws, because they're subject privately to these lawsuits for, you know, constitutional civil rights issues. I think that brings it together where we're now very much in tune with what are our rights, how are they protected, who is going to protect them, are we going to keep this individual or this company, or are we going to switch up to somebody better? All wealthy individuals, very wealthy individuals, we're talking billionaires, have that type of structure in place.
Yeah.
And so they know it works. I think that we could do that on a very much smaller scale, or at least on a city level, city to city level. And then the cities that became safe and very well secured, people would move there, they would thrive, and that policy would either play out to work well or not. Other cities that didn't do very well, they would be dangerous and people would flee from it.
So you mentioned policing.
Yeah.
It's one of the things that the federal government really doesn't need to be involved in.
Or even the state government.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Because when we think about what does a government have to do, we've become so used to the government doing so much. Mm-hmm. They build roads. They build parks.
Yeah,
they put in all of the infrastructure, right? And the major threat that if we don't go along with the federal policy, or if it's a state policy with that, that they pull that funding. Well, what if we say, hey, fine, pull your funding, right? We're gonna do it our way. We're gonna hire this private agency to do it. Then what it does is it puts the people in control. And that's really what freedom is the ability to have control, to make the decision and either suffer the consequences if they're bad decisions, or reap the benefits if they're good decisions.
So going along that line, as you're talking, I'm thinking, okay, well, what about here on the, like in our city, if the city was to say, you know what, we're getting rid of this department, the Parks and Rec department,
yeah,
getting rid of the police department, we're getting rid of all this stuff. So I'm electing people to the city council, and in your model, it would be the city council is acting on the best for the best interests of the city in a way that hopefully I want them to, because that's why I voted for that individual to be on the city council. But instead of them going and taking tax money and saying, we're going to put it into this big fat fund that's allocated to Parks and Rec and nobody really has any oversight or any way of auditing that, we as the people,
mm-hmm,
you're saying they go direct to a contractor. So they would say, you contractor, we want to use you to build this park, and we want to use this contractor to maintain that park, and we're going to allocate this much to that contract of the tax money. So there's no levels of bureaucracy in between. It's just straight from the city council to the contractors.
Well,
or do you have to have layers of bureaucracy?
So the city council, they've got to have a procurement officer, right? They've got to have somebody that knows how contracts should work, whether or not a contract they're being presented with contains the safeguards in there that are going to make sure that there's penalties if the contract isn't fulfilled, and there's timelines that are set, and there's budgetary issues that are going to be abided by. But and that individual, if you look at their salary in the city right now, the procurement officer, they're the highest paid city officer. They're the highest paid city employee. They're making in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. How much does a city council member make? They make like
45, maybe, if that. No,
4,500.
No, 1,000 a year, right?
City council member.
Yeah.
No, I think it's like between $3,000 and $6,000 a year.
A year, okay.
Yeah. So, there you go. We've always matched competency with compensation, and I think the city council members, they are public servants. And they're doing their best, but they're not getting paid. And so they're 100% basically volunteers doing their best. And we're getting what volunteers doing their best provide. And so that doesn't result in a whole lot of accountability. A lot of times it doesn't result in a whole lot of business experience. It doesn't result in people willing to toe the line and take people to court that break contracts. It results in, okay, we're going through the formalities of this meeting, and as long as I sit and act through the formality without making a fool of myself, I'm going to stay out of the limelight. I'm still going to get the recognition as a city council member, but I'm not going to like stir any pots, and I don't have a whole lot to lose.
That's how you view the city council?
That's exactly how I view the city council. As the city council members were making the type of money that we pay CEOs and other high business level individuals that make the types of decisions and manage the type of money that they're making, they would be making hundreds of thousands of dollars. And rightfully so. I mean, we pay these sports owners. Well, we don't pay the owners. The owners pay the coaches and the athletes to perform. Right, and the ones that have the bigger budgets, they happen to win. It's not coincidence that the ones that get paid the higher salary are the ones that win. Right, it's not the coincidence that Nick Saban and the Alabama Tide, they were the dynasty for the football college football scene for the past 15 years. It's because he was one of the highest paid coaches out there, and when somebody offers him more money and a better situation, he goes elsewhere. That is how the world works. It always has, it always will. And when we offer somebody nothing to do something that has a large amount of responsibility, then what we get is as diplomatic as possible, but we get incompetency.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because I was listening to a discourse by Gordon B. Hinckley not too long ago, a few weeks ago, and in it he said something about this concept you're talking about. He said the world, in part, will pay you what it thinks you're worth, and I think that's the concept you're talking about. I don't know if I totally agree with the city council paying them more money will result in better results. I don't think so. I think as you're talking, I'm thinking about Congress. I mean, we pay our Congress members and our senators a lot of money, and I feel like that does not result in a better result. I think I've argued long and hard about reducing the amount that a senator gets and term limits and things like that. I think that would be great for our American system of government. Mm-hmm. If we paid them less money and it was truly a sacrifice for them to go to Washington, D.C. and to actually represent us, I want it to be a sacrifice for them. Mm-hmm. I feel like, and this maybe this isn't true, but this is the way I feel, is once you your goal is to do anything you can to be elected as a senator. Because mm-hmm. once you get elected once, now you've got these benefits for life.
Yeah. And also
salary and everything that comes with it. And I'm thinking,
but it's corrupt. And there's a lot of money in the corruption in Congress. For example, if people participate in inside trading and they know where the market's going to go and what a company, when a company is going to become worth a lot more, or when it's going to start to drop its value, then they know where to invest their money in the stocks. And if you do that on a private level, you go to prison for a long time. Martha Stewart, she wasn't above that, right? She was very popular and very wealthy. She was able to afford the best defense attorneys, but she still went to prison because she participated in inside trading. She knew what was going to happen with the company before it happened. She pulled out a bunch of money right before it failed, and it saved her a bunch of money, and other people who didn't have that same type of private information lost money. Well, Congress does that all the time. If you look at the net worth of these individuals before they went to Congress and after they went to Congress, it's not the salary that's making them rich. It's the fact that they get insider trading information, and more than just information, they're sitting on the committees that are making the policies that determine whether or not these companies are going to be successful.
Coming up, more thought-provoking conversations on life, death, and the law right after this. You're listening to Life, Death, and the Law, presented by Deason, Garner, and Hanson, the law firm that has been voted Yuma's best 6 years in a row.
So you got Elizabeth Warren in there, where she went in originally into politics, and she was worth maybe $1 million, and she's now worth probably $70 million. You got Nancy Pelosi that was worth $1 million, maybe two, and now she's worth individually, I think, over $100 million. You got, and it's on both sides of the aisle. So they're absolutely corrupt in the money that they receive. So do these individuals do it because the salary for a congressperson is like $250,000, something like that?
Yeah, senator, I believe.
And so they're not going, oh, well, you know, I've got enough money, and or either way, I'll live on what I can with $250,000. And I'm going to do it just because I love my country so much. A lot of these individuals are willing to sell their soul to get money through the backdoor deals, and they do it that way. But if we said, okay, we're cutting out, you cannot participate in market at all, in the stock market, if you are in Congress, you're done. The compensation that you receive is strictly going to be the compensation that is paid for that office. And I think if we paid a lot for that office, we could double it, triple it, and still be saving the taxpayers millions of billions of dollars because of the corruption that goes by. Because a senator, in order to give a contract that's $1 billion to get a kickback of a couple million dollars, will do it. And what did that cost the taxpayer? A couple million dollars? No. It cost the taxpayer a couple $1 billion because of the contract that was given. So if we just paid the senator $1 million to begin with to keep them straight and eliminated or prosecuted legitimately any of these backdoor deals, then I think it would clean up a lot of that type of activity. I looked up how much city council members make. They make $3,500. So it wasn't too far off. And I think
a year?
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense to me.
I know. That's the whole point. It doesn't make sense. The mayor makes $12,000. So it's $3,600, and the mayor makes $12,000. And we had a proposition, which I voted in favor of, is Proposition 425. It was on the ballot for November 2024 to raise a salary for the mayor to $45,000 and the council members to $25,000, which I still thought was insufficient. For the amount of power and money that they control, we don't want somebody making $25,000. I pay people that clean my building $25,000. I don't pay people that make decisions about where I put all my advertising money, what kind of construction contracts I do around the building, what type of business decisions that we're going to be making on a day-to-day basis. I don't pay them $25,000. They get paid much more than that. And why would we do that with somebody that's running the entire city? The city council is literally running the city, or at least supposedly, but the members that we get there, I think, are so easily manipulated by the higher paid individuals, the city procurement officer, that whoever he decides is going to get the contract, he can go and persuade the city council that that's the legitimate person to get the contract. I've personally been involved in lawsuits against the city where the procurement officer awarded a contract to a bid that was illegal in the way that it was submitted. It did not list the subcontractors that were going to be providing the work. And my client had provided a legal bid, and I sued the city and I said, listen, we want to have the legal bid be awarded the contract. And the city council sat there, they listened to a little bit of testimony. They only gave us like 45 minutes to describe what was going on, and said, here are the actual ordinances. It says that the subcontractors that are actually going to be doing the work, they have to be listed in the proposal. If they are not, it's not a valid proposal. This contract that you're awarding this individual, the subcontractors are not listed. So you must reject it. Now, are you going to uphold the law of the city ordinances, or are you going to save a couple $1,000s? What are you going to do, city council? And all of them voted to save a couple $1,000s. Why? Because they'd already had their mind made up beforehand by the city attorney, by the city procurement officer, that this is the best way to go. You know, lawyers are always going to try to change your mind, but they're just out there to kick up dust and stir the pot, and so they can make money from their legal fees. But in reality, the city council just wasn't thinking for themselves. They weren't looking at the ordinances and saying, this is what we are here to enforce to make sure that our constituents are protected by the ordinances that are in place.
I think your reasoning would be well-founded if not for the way that people get on the city council, and that's through the electoral system. And so it's like, yeah. It's more of like a popularity contest in high school to me when it comes to putting people on the city council. And so if you raise their salary, that doesn't mean they're qualified by any means. It just means they're more popular in the
electoral system. But more qualified individuals will be seeking that position because qualified individuals go where the money is.
I don't know.
Because
I don't know if that tracks for government.
Okay. Well, the procurement officer, if you would ask him if he's going to give up his, I want to look up right now how much the city procurement officer makes, but if you would ask him, would you give up your behind the scene role? Because they never ask a procurement officer to stand up at these events that we have, whenever we have these charitable events or we have these Yuma awards, they always say, who are the city council members here? And they have them stand up and everybody claps for them and they recognize them. Say, okay, give up your $200,000 salary so you can actually be the city council member making the decisions. He'd be like, no, they can have all the applause that they want. I'm actually making the decisions because I know what the contract says and I've been through business school. I've either worked for other large corporations or other cities.
Solid, sure.
Yeah, and I've demonstrated that I can actually get projects done, that I can negotiate with contractors and get a fair deal, or at least keep things moving along. And he's not going to give up his $200,000 job for the city council role. Now, how many people voted for members of city council in the Yuma election? Of the total amount of people that are registered to vote in the city, I think the number is about 40,000. And I'm pulling that off the top of my head. We could look that up. You could Google it. But of those that actually voted for city council members, 14,000 even cast their vote. And how much did they research the individual candidates? How many times were the candidates going and debating one another and demonstrating to the public, to the Yuma residents, I'm a better candidate because I've got this business experience. And how much time, airtime did they get? How much attention did we pay to them? I'll tell you honestly, of someone that tries to stay informed, I didn't recognize the names of probably 60% of the individuals that were running for city council. I didn't even recognize their names. Mm-hmm. That's ridiculous. That shows that the money that is affecting us, our kids right now, what parks they go to, whether we have a water park or not, whether or not we have a swim park or not, whether or not we have a city pool running or not, we're not paying attention to the individuals that are making those decisions.
Yeah.
The mayor is not picking the city council.
I'm saying that's the model that we would have to go to.
No, I think that we could, as constituents, have a lot more money and limelight put on to who the city council members are. Because if they're that type of corporation, their board of directors, they're going to make hundreds of thousands, if not millions, right? Mm-hmm. And because they're controlling so much money. And we need to have super highly qualified individuals that have a track record of success. You have presidents of universities, they're making that type of money. Why? Why are they making that type of money? Because it's a high valued position and they want that university to have success. There's other universities that are competing for individual students to enroll in their university. And so they're getting paid that. You got basketball coaches out there making $5 million, $10 million. And that's because it attracts individuals to come to that university. It attracts the crowds to watch the university compete in those events. And if on a city level, we say, hey, we see the same thing. When you pay people a higher level of compensation to get success and threaten to pull them from that position when success isn't achieved, then I think you're going to have much higher qualified candidates. Now, the candidates themselves are going to attract all that attention. The position, if we say, okay, now the position for city council member is $250,000. Think about that, $1.5 million for a group of six city council members, right? Is my math right there? All right.
Sure.
Well, we'll say my math's right. We're at $1.5 million of individuals paying out a salary to manage $520 million. I think that's reasonable. That's less than 1%. That's far less than 1%. And
I think, yes, in a perfect world where those individuals were qualified.
Yeah, but $250,000, they're going to attract some highly qualified business individuals to be competing. They're going to be saying, I want that position. You know what? I'm going to go out to every news station. I'm going to be out there. I'm going to be on the stage. I'm going to be telling why my opponent doesn't have the qualifications that I do. I'm going to be spreading my resume out there. I'm going to be vetted because other individuals are going to be looking back into my past and see whether or not I cheated on other business deals or whether or not I paid my taxes or all these different things because the position is coveted. And so the limelight, the media, scrutiny is going to be on that individual.
Maybe, in theory. I mean, that's what we see in presidential elections.
Well, in presidential elections, obviously, because, I mean, you wield so much power, right? And President Trump, I don't know if he is this year, but last term he didn't accept or he donated back the salary that he received.
How come you never hear about that? I don't know if it's true because I've not heard of it. Like the media doesn't talk about it. I've never heard it in a story or article.
Okay.
So I don't know if that's true.
Well, let's say ChatGPT is never wrong. What's your guess?
I think it's going to say something like Trump is a 20-time convicted felon.
So what ChatGPT is saying is, yeah, he didn't actually keep the money, but it wasn't all charitable because he gave it back to the government agencies that he liked the best. Well, guess what, ChatGPT? He's the president. He can favor different organizations within his administration that he wants
to. And he never benefited from it, so.
Right. He could get far more benefits just by making a decision and signing a document than giving them $400,000, mm-hmm. right? What Elon Musk was disclosing was $400 billion. Otherwise, it wouldn't make a headline when agencies were wasting money.
Kind of makes me frustrated. I mean, he did that. And then to know what happened behind the scenes in those agencies now, it's like it was a complete waste.
Well, depending on what agency. He chose the agency and then says, hey, I want this agency to receive this money.
Well, I think the challenge would be like, I thought it was going to say donated it to charity. But then is the government favoring certain charities over others? And is that a constitutional issue? Like, would that be a lawsuit just waiting to happen? That sucks.
So in 2017, he donated his quarterly salary to the National Park Service to help maintain historical battlefields. Does that sound like a back end deal to try to get a pat on the back and get something, some money under the table?
Yeah.
No, it doesn't, honestly. It sounds like he legitimately made his own money doing something that people willingly paid him to do and then used the public money to benefit, in this case, a national park to sustain battlefield memorials.
I want to know more. Now I'm curious to see, like, what's that been going to? And is he doing it this term?
So my point is individuals at that high-end level of national government, they've already made it on their own. And oftentimes, those who haven't, many of those Congress members that are now worth 10, 20, 30 times more than they were when they came into Congress, that is not because they automatically became so smart at investing. It's because they controlled the investments.
Mm-hmm.
They controlled the market. And that's where the corruption comes in.
And I know we got to go.
Okay.
But we'll talk to you next week. This is Life, Death, and the Law.
If you have questions or want to know more about something that was discussed today, please call the law firm of Deason, Garner, and Hanson at 928-783-4575 or visit YumaEstatePlanning.com.